You're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona. Welcome to the program, A Good Book. This is part 7 of the book, Late for the Bus, An Adoption Story, Finding My Birth Parents, Jerry and Joanne Buss. I'm your volunteer reader, Lee Close, and I am also the author of the book. This is the true story of finding my birth parents after years of fruitless searching, only to discover that I am the eldest daughter of Dr. Gerald Buss, the multimillionaire, legendary owner of the Los Angeles Lakers, and his wife, Joanne. In the previous broadcast, we entered the tumultuous teenage years with the first job, a runaway attempt that lasted 24 hours from Arizona to California, a marriage, a divorce, and single motherhood. Continuing on with the book now. Once I felt more secure financially, the first thing on my mind was to get back into school. In 1974, Glendale Community College was basically tuition-free and used textbooks were inexpensive. The campus was large and open, with tall palm trees lining the walkways, an expansive green lawn, and a beautiful rose garden. Being among other students, carrying books, and visiting the library gave me that same sense of happiness I felt in sixth grade at Catalina. I just had this incredible, everything will be okay feeling. If I concentrated on my studies, it was possible to receive an Associate of Arts degree within a couple of years. Later that year, I purchased a Hallcraft home on 42nd Avenue in Cavalier for just under $18,000. I used the proceeds from the sale of the home awarded in the divorce for the down payment. This home was made of red brick. It was a spacious 3-bedroom, 2-bath home built in 1957. The mortgage payment was about $135 a month. The backyard was large, with Bermuda grass and 2 prolific plum trees. The house needed some work, including a roof, so I ordered asphalt shingles. The first layer of the roof would serve as the underlayment. Friends came to help. It was a simple A-line roof with no additional gables. I know we didn't install the shingles in the proper pattern, and a decade later when I drove by the house, I shuddered at the workmanship. I recently looked up the house on the internet. The house looked pretty much the same, but the roof had been replaced and the big mulberry tree out front was gone. It's still a darling red brick home. The Zillow estimate in early 2022 was $337,300. Chapter 7, Corporate Career Days. To succeed in life, you need 3 things: a wishbone, a backbone, and a funny bone. Reba McEntire. Sometimes life unfolds in ways you cannot even imagine. One evening in 1974, I received a phone call from a friend, Carrie, who was sobbing as she tried to speak. I could barely understand her. She told me she had interviewed for a position with Rubbermaid Consumer Products as a market representative, calling on stores, stocking shelves, and building promotional displays. She was offered the position, only to have her husband refuse to give his permission. He did not want her to be out there working with store managers, in other words, with men. She was heartbroken. "Call the man I interviewed with and tell him I can't take the job and ask if you can interview." I did exactly that. I interviewed and got the job. My title was market representative. My annual salary was $5,100 with full benefits. I had my expense account, a gas card, and a nearly new gold 1973 Gran Torino as my company car. I was 21 years old. My next-door neighbor was a stay-at-home mom with a young daughter, the same age as my son. Who could dream that up? She was happy to make a little extra money, and the kids already knew each other. I started my job immediately, calling on stores all over Arizona, Phoenix, Flagstaff, Tucson, Yuma, and all small towns in between. My district manager believed in me and gave me opportunities beyond my range of duties. In addition to stocking shelves, I was given responsibility to reorder product and present new product to store managers. I called on accounts like Kmart and Skaggs Drugs and Luke Air Force Base. I loved the challenge and I worked hard. My district manager wrote letters to the regional vice president about my progress and enthusiasm, and a few years later I was promoted to sales representative, a position usually reserved for employees with four-year degrees. My sister Christine and her husband gave birth to a son, Jamie, in 1977, the same year I remarried. I sold my red brick house, and my new husband, Paul, and I purchased a home less than 8 miles away. It was on a cul-de-sac with a large backyard and a large swimming pool. My next project was to get braces on my teeth. My husband had perfectly straight teeth as the result of having braces as a child. I had large, crowded teeth. So in addition to needing my wisdom teeth pulled, I had to have four additional teeth removed first before the orthodontist could begin to correct the misalignment. When I told Mom how excited I was, she asked me, "Why don't you just have them all pulled?" In her generation, that's what you did. While working at a trade show in New York, I was having lunch with my local buyer from Smitty's grocery store in Phoenix when a small rubber band flew off one of the metal brackets of my new braces and landed right in front of him. Thank goodness it didn't land in his salad. It was one of those moments you can't make up. He thought it was funny, so I laughed along with him. My dad loved to hear stories about my work and my travels. He was no longer working, and his health continued to decline. Mom had retired to take care of him and earn some extra money babysitting my son after school. My parents continued to smoke heavily until I stepped in one day and told them that I could no longer bring their grandson over because of his allergies. It was a beneficial threat, because they both quit immediately, and we didn't skip a beat. Dad continued sponsoring alcoholics at home. Scott still remembers quietly absorbing the AA 12 steps while playing with his fire truck in their living room. Mom and Dad were now in their mid-60s and finally had the time to enjoy being grandparents, always ready to babysit. In 1979, my parents celebrated their 40th anniversary with a ceremony that everyone in the family attended. It was a sweet day for them. My dad composed the opening remarks. "An ideal marriage is one where each needs the other because they love the other. It is not where each loves the other because they need the other. An ideal spouse is a companion, a friend, and a fellow worker who shares with the other both the good and the bad. For that to be possible, such a union is surely based upon spiritual principles and, as such, God is surely a party to such a union." In 1979, my birth father, Dr. Jerry Buss, after making millions in real estate, purchased the Los Angeles Lakers, the LA Kings, the Forum, and a ranch from Jack Kent Cook for $67.5 million. With my husband working locally and my parents now retired and willing to babysit, I felt more comfortable working even harder to advance my career. In 1980, Rubbermaid promoted me to district manager, housewares division. I was not only the youngest district manager in the history of the company, I was also the first female. I was 27 years old. In 1980, my birth father, Dr. Jerry Buss, would win his first NBA championship as the Lakers defeated Philadelphia 76ers 4-2. Paul and I sold our first home and purchased our next home just a few miles away from the first one. This home also had a big backyard and pool and included a 10x12 office separate from the house. My new home office had a big walnut desk, a teleautograph machine, precursor to the fax machine, and a separate phone line. Look out, world! Rubbermaid tested each new manager with the Myers-Briggs Type Indicator, MBTI, personality test. My results listed me as an ENFJ, E for extroversion, N for intuition, F for feeling, and J for judging. ENFJ traits are listed as action-oriented, extroverted, interaction with people and interpersonal relationships, human-centered, meaningful. No surprise, the results matched my DECA career aptitude results in high school. In my second year in sales management, I was number one in sales increases in the nation. I traveled extensively, covering 3 states, responsible for 3 direct sales employees and 2 food broker account managers. Fortunately, my husband Paul's office was in Phoenix, so he was home every night and a pretty good cook, too. My husband was in the food industry and often received free tickets to sporting events through sponsors. We attended professional team games like the Phoenix Suns, NBA basketball, and the Phoenix Firebirds, minor league baseball. We went to PGA and LPGA golf tournaments and Arizona State college football games. You name it, we were there. While continuing to work full-time, I returned to college and attended classes at night. I received my BA with a double major in English and psychology, graduating magna cum laude from Ottawa University, a small Baptist college with a local Phoenix campus. I had lots of time to study and write while traveling for work, flying around the country for my job. Having my nose stuck in a textbook also kept the passenger in the adjacent seat from talking to me constantly. With the Rubbermaid headquarters in Ohio, it was necessary to have a home office, which had many advantages. A new neighbor moved in across the street and invited me over for tea. Anne was a tall, elegant woman in her 50s with deep blue eyes. She had a great big smile and wore bubblegum pink lipstick. Anne maintained a private practice as a marriage and family therapist, and we hit it off immediately. We both had control over our home office hours and spent many late afternoons talking about anything and everything. She had a way of offering counsel without seeming to do so. When my son seemed overly upset whenever the death of a celebrity was announced on the news, she asked if he was in contact with his biological father. No, definitely not. Well, Scott may be suffering from an unresolved death. Can you get in contact with his father and arrange a visit? It was something I did not want to do, particularly since he was remarried with 2 children. But I arranged a visit, and much to my surprise, the first thing he did was apologize to me. Scott visited him a few times, but came home one day and told me he didn't want to go there anymore. Anne was right. My son's fixation on death diminished and eventually disappeared. You're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, and I'm your volunteer reader, Lee Close. Back to the story. Change is inevitable. In 1982, during a Rubbermaid sales meeting in Cleveland, Ohio, the new corporate president urged us at the end of the meeting to look around you because by next year, half of you will no longer be here. I began to agonize over the future. products made in America were being copied by overseas manufacturers at a lower cost, and profits were being squeezed. He announced that the present force of 32 district managers would be reduced to 16. I was still the only female district manager. Although I had been ranked in the top 10 for sales increases each year, this ominous warning loomed large. Soon, while on my way home during a layover in Dallas, I scribbled my intention on a piece of paper to have a new job by my 29th birthday, less than a year away. I called a well-known recruiter who listed major companies as clients. She set up an interview for me with the new consumer products division of Avery Label. After several interviews, I was offered a job in sales and accepted, in writing, 3 days after my 29th birthday. I was criticized by friends and colleagues for taking a step backwards from district manager to sales representative, but I was tired of the housewares industry and wanted to learn something new. Besides, who doesn't like office supplies? It was a growing industry, and I was the first female sales rep hired by Avery. Being the first female district manager at Rubbermaid gave me the chutzpah that I needed to work with this new group of hard-driving men at Avery. I made Achievement Club my first year and played lots of golf on nice courses. I learned how to play poker with the guys, but one of the vice presidents smoked big fat cigars, and the smell and the smoke got to me, so I bowed out of the games as early and as gracefully as I could. Looking back, selling labels was a breeze. Being in the office supply industry felt like redress for that pivotal day back in second grade when I was ushered into class late and saw all my classmates with their new pencils, erasers, scissors, and crayons. In 1982, my biological father, Dr. Buss, won his second NBA championship as his Lakers defeated Philadelphia once again. Avery had acquired an index company, Aigner, and wanted to combine the two sales forces. The executive committee wanted to explore the idea but keep it under wraps. They chose me to test the idea of selling both lines in the Arizona market, where I was the sole representative. The test was a success, and less than 18 months after going to work with Avery, I was offered a new position in the California headquarters, based in Covina, a town I had lived in as a teenager back in the 1960s. I would report to both the vice president of sales and the vice president of marketing and be responsible for the sales training portion during the merger of the two separate national sales forces. What an opportunity! I accepted immediately. Paul, Scott, and I packed a U-Haul and moved to Southern California on Memorial Day, 1984. Big city, big dreams, big fun. It didn't occur to me until writing this book that my mom had been a resident of Los Angeles during the 1932 Olympics. Just prior to our move to California, my parents purchased their cemetery lots in Glendale, Arizona on March 21, 1984, for a total of $630. The timing seemed odd to me, and I felt guilty about leaving my parents, but we came to visit them often. Each time we were about to return to California, my dad would say, "I hope I'm still here when you come over next time." It was also difficult to say goodbye to my neighbor and closest friend, Ann. When I told her we were moving to Southern California, she said she would miss me, but we would always keep in touch and be together whenever possible. Ann and I had many conversations about my adoption, and as soon as I became a California resident, adoption questions would once again float to the surface. Are my birth parents living in Southern California? Are they still alive? Should I try to find them? In 1984, the Los Angeles metropolitan area had about 10 million people. My husband secured a regional sales position with a national food company that allowed him to work from home. we purchased a house in Irvine, joined the local Presbyterian church, and arranged for him to adopt my son, Scott. Living in the Los Angeles area once again felt oddly comfortable, but a bit anxiety-driven at the same time. My commute to work was about an hour each way. Scott was beginning eighth grade, and after his first day at school, he came home upset. "Mom, I can't wear any of my clothes to school." An Arizona wardrobe of jeans and t-shirts didn't cut it. Lots of peer pressure in Irvine. Khaki pants, plaid shirts, and new shoes soon filled his closet. He wore a tuxedo for his graduation, and many of the girls wore off-the-shoulder gowns, arriving to commencement in limousines. In 1984, Scott attended a basketball camp in Santa Barbara and had his photo taken with NBA All-Star Jamal Wilkes. Wilkes was a standout player with the Los Angeles Lakers, the team owned by Dr. Jerry Buss. How curious it seems today that the young boy with whom Wilkes was kind enough to pose was Dr. Buss's biological grandson. Scott played several sports in addition to basketball, including golf, soccer, and baseball. Nevertheless, we enjoyed all the perks of living in Southern California, including season tickets to the Rams football team in Anaheim. John Robinson was the head coach, coming over from USC just a few years prior. Seats were reasonably priced, and the atmosphere was lively but family-friendly. Saying goodbye to Aunt Faye. My sweet Aunt Faye had been ill with respiratory issues for years, but continued to smoke. She was born on October 26, 1915, in Little River County, Arkansas, and died at the age of 69 on April 19, 1985, just 2 years after my grandmother's death from leukemia. The last time I saw my aunt alive was in an oxygen tent in the hospital. With paper and clipboard in hand, she looked at me, then took a pen and scribbled, "Scared. Can't breathe. Dying." I saw the fear in her eyes. Cigarettes and dirty air killed the person I loved and admired so much. I was crushed. I called my friend Anne, who gently reminded me of the special relationship a girl has with her aunt, who is one step removed from the burdens and responsibilities that a mother carries. That was so true in my life. Aunt Faye's stability and love of home was helpful not only to me, but also to my mom. Seeing Aunt Faye so still and so quiet at her wake was shattering. It was only my second time viewing a body. Uncle George was in front of me in line. He walked up to the casket and touched her hand. "Damn it, Faye." Softly and tenderly spoken, those were his true words of love, spoken as only he could. How lucky I was to have spent so much time with them as a child. My aunt never worked a day in her life, quite the opposite of her sister, who struggled constantly while managing to keep the family intact. Shortly after Aunt Faye's death, I wrote a poem hinting of my adoption, but also in celebration of her significance in my life. "Where is my village? I cannot see it. It will not come to me. I must choose my ancestors as they chose not to choose me. My aunt, whose blood I do not share, yet her thoughts still flow in my veins today, her songs humming all around me, the missing key on Middle C, crossword puzzles and the Barbie doll dress she sewed for me, the revolving color wheel lighting up the silver tree. Oh, how I could look at it forever. Johnny Carson, Lakers on TV, warm the dark night fears. She was always out there, listening, laughing. Betsy McCall, paper dolls, decorating cakes. Don't let that screen door slam. Summers, winters, patterns of life, she was always humming. 1985. Aunt Faye never missed a Lakers game. She was a true fan. She died in April 1985 and missed the Lakers beating the Celtics on June 9th for the NBA championship. What a thrill that would have been for her. This would be the third Lakers championship for Dr. Buss since purchasing the team in 1979. Dr. Buss and Karen Dimmel, his longtime girlfriend, would give birth to my first half-sibling, Joey Buss. That's all the time we have for reading today. I hope you're enjoying the book, Late for the Buss, An Adoption Story, Finding My Birth Parents, Jerry and Joanne Buss. You've been listening to the program, A Good Book. This is Sun Sounds of Arizona and your volunteer reader, Lee Close. Thank you so much for joining me today.